failed each other because we are uncomfortable talking about healthy sexuality in our culture, which is kind of bizarre when you think about it, because we put it everywhere. It's on all of the screens. We use, sexual imagery to sell everything from dishwashing soap to blue jeans.
That's writer Lori Holtz Anderson. She has a new book out. It's a memoir written in free verse style, revealing her experience as a sexual assault survivor. It's called Shout, and it's what we're reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of What We're Reading. It's our show all about books, who's writing them, and who's reading them. On today's program, we'll hear from Bemidji poet Erin Lynn Marsh. Her very first book of poems was recently published. It's called Disability Isn't Sexy. Writer Susan Meisner will tell us about her latest work of historical fiction. It's called The Last Year of the War. Community member Ruthie Wilson will tell us about one of her all-time favorite books, Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. It's award season, so we'll hear all about the winners of the 2019 Minnesota Book Awards. And towards the end of the hour, we'll hear more from writer Lori Holtz Anderson. Her new free verse memoir is called Shout. You'll definitely want to stick around for our very important conversation on sexual assault and survival and fostering a culture of consent. Stay tuned. Erin Lynn Marsh is a poet living in Bemidji. She has her Master's of Fine Arts from Lesley University in Boston, Massachusetts. Her poetry has been published in the Poets Speak anthology Hers, Emery's Journal, Post Road, and Word Gathering, a journal of disability, poetry, and literature. And now her very first and very own book of poems has been published. It's called Disability Isn't Sexy, and Erin Lynn Marsh joins me now. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell me about your new book of poems. It's Disability Isn't Sexy. What went into getting these poems written and published?
Well, when I first started writing poetry, I really avoided the topic of disability.
Why but, so?
Well, because I just didn't want to be labeled like a disabled poet, and that's all I could write about. But it just sort of needed to happen. I needed to write these poems, and they just kept coming. It was just right there, and I needed to do it. And I was blessed with a very supportive writing group here in Bemidji, and they helped me to get these poems out and feel good about them.
Is it hard to ignore a topic that is so much a part of who you are?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's very hard because really you have to write about like what is preoccupying you. And that's really what writing poetry is about. What are you thinking about all the time? What is on your mind? You have to follow that.
But you don't want to be labeled as the disability poet.
Correct. Yeah, I want to be able to write about other things. And I feel that now that I have this collection together, I will be able to move forward.
Now, how did you decide which poems made it into this book?
I was very, very lucky. My friend Jules Nyquist, who lives in Albuquerque, she helped me to put this book of poems together. And at first, it was a much bigger collection. But I realized that I just really wanted to focus on disability poems and otherness. And so that's how I began to sort of like, you know, get them down to the exact ones I was going to have in the book. So the book is in three sections. I think it worked out because in the middle now I have some poems about sea life. But really, in reality, it's about otherness.
And what do you mean by otherness?
Otherness to me is that there is something about you that is a little bit different than everybody else, that you know about things that other people wouldn't know about. And not because they lack intelligence, but just because they've not lived the experience.
Right. Let's hear a poem now. I wonder if you would go ahead and read What You Should Know Before Our First Date.
Sure. What You Should Know Before Our First Date. I have prepared for this evening by applying a bit of color to my cheeks in hopes you will kiss me. This way I can enjoy your lips without needing to pretend to be bashful. I don't water my plants nearly enough. Even though I live alone, I cook for two, setting good food at the entrance to the cave of my desire. I am a believer in sensible shoes. Soon, even brightly colored tattoos won't be enough to hide my shame. You won't hurt me, even if your hands grasp my scarred hips. Pull me close.
So what I think I really love about this poem is how there are so many things in there that I think are universal feelings.
Yeah.
Most people don't water their plants enough. I believe in sensible shoes myself. But there's a lot of vulnerability and intimacy that you are revealing as far as your disabilities in this poem, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that just made a really neat juxtaposition.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I tried to do in this collection is juxtapose things that are completely normal and human and people just, everyone thinks about it. And then things that I specifically have to think about. Yeah, just try to make it real to the reader that, yeah, oh, you have to think about that.
Right. It's a good balance because you're finding things, we find things to relate to, and then we learn about what it is to live with disability.
Yeah.
I'm talking with poet Erin Lynn Marsh of Bemidji. Her debut book of poems has just been published. It's called Disability Isn't Sexy. Could you also read, In Your Other Life, There Is No Blue Cane?
Sure. In your other life, there is no blue cane with silver filigree. There is a bicycle, mint green, sturdy. It gets you everywhere in the fabulous city where you learn to take up space, to revel in drivers' honking reminders to restrict yourself to a narrow bike lane. What happened? This life finds you unsteady as a woman twice your age. You are still right-handed, so your foam-handled cane becomes an inelegant magnet attracted to Earth's core, keeps you stuck. You frequently dream of pushing pedals, of finding yourself across town due to your body's efforts. Your poems conjure the plaster body cast you wore as a toddler, how you would flap your arms, a dull-hued hummingbird distraught in her inability to hover.
Wow, that's really powerful.
Thank you.
I want to focus on the idea of allowing yourself to take up space.
Yes.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. I think when we are brought up, especially as women, we're told, yeah, you don't take up space. You need to make yourself as inconspicuous as possible. It just all reminds me when I lived in Minneapolis and I would ride the bus, it was just, I just would get so squished up and squished in because I just didn't want anyone to feel like they had to touch me or anything. And that's really, it's a really awful feeling.
Yeah.
And I just believe that, you know, we need to take up the space that we need. I mean, there's a whole world out there. You can have your space.
The poems in Disability Isn't Sexy are intimate, they're revealing, and they show a lot of vulnerability. Are you uncomfortable sharing that with the world?
I'm not uncomfortable sharing it because I think that vulnerability is what, you know, makes us human and makes us interesting to other people. And I think the only way to talk about something as difficult as living with a disability is to make yourself vulnerable, put yourself out there, let people know how you feel, how it feels to be in this world.
Right. Great. Now, as a writer, I'm guessing that you read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any poets that are really influential to you?
The first poet that ever told me that it was possible, really, to be a poet as like a living or something you could be as a profession is Lucille Clifton. So her poems are really treasured by me. I just think she's a wonderful writer. And then some new ones that I've been reading, Kaveh Akbar, he writes a beautiful book, Calling a Wolf a Wolf. It's very now, and it is about addiction. So there's that vulnerability piece again. And then Gillian Weiss also writes about disability. she's very good, very blunt, which I like. And then Ada Limone. She's somebody that I've been reading a lot of lately. And then I'll be studying with her this summer at the Northwoods Writers Conference.
Oh, great. Great. In Bemidji.
Mm-hmm.
Great. What's next for you? Are you working on any new projects?
I am. You know, it's easier to conceive of a second book once you have a first.
Okay.
Because before that, you're like, you know, it's not real to you. But so, yeah, I am working on a book of poems. They're love poems, but not in the traditional sense. They're love poems of not that I need or anybody needs another person, but it's desire and it's a want. Yeah. So it's exploring that idea of how in our culture everything sort of revolves around love. It doesn't need to.
Okay. And you have a sample of a new poem that you're working on?
Sure.
Yep.
This is called "It Is True My Chest Aches Because the Loneliness That Pools There Leaves Behind a Heaviness Doctors Dismiss as Anxiety, a Panic That Must Be Immediately Dealt With. What would those doctors say if they knew I do not take the prescribed pills? Instead, I collect them in a glass box on the bathroom vanity, hoarding them like the chalky pearls of a candy necklace. I will someday string them on a piece of floss, knotted tightly, bury in the garden beneath my bedroom window. Come spring, a pastel bloom, I'll steep in boiling water, breathe the steam to softly loosen sadness.
That was poet Erin Lynn Marsh from Bemidji on her brand new book of poems called Disability Isn't Sexy. Erin, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to What We're Reading on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear from community member Ruthie Wilson, a review of the 2019 Minnesota Book Awards, and writer Lori Haltz Anderson on her new memoir, Shout. Coming up, Susan Meisner on the last year of the war.
Hits my shield and ignites.
Susan Meisner is the author of several works of historical fiction, including As Bright as Heaven, Secrets of a Charmed Life, and The Girl in the Glass. Her new book is The Last Year of the War. It's the story of Elise Sontag, a 14-year-old girl born and raised in Iowa. When Elise's German-born father is suspected of being a Nazi sympathizer, Elise and her family are shipped off to an internment camp in Texas. Here's my conversation with Susan Meisner. The last year of the war shifts back and forth between the 1940s and near present day, where we learn that the now elderly Elise Sontag has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and before her condition worsens, she is determined to find her long-lost friend Mariko, whom she met while in the internment camp. Tell us about Elise's and Mariko's friendship.
Well, when they meet, they're both kind of thrown into a very extraordinary situation. They're both American teenagers. They're born in America. They have American citizenship, but their parents are immigrants to the U.S. And so Elise's parents are German immigrants. They've been in country for 16 years, but they're not citizens. And for a bunch of little circumstantial reasons, Elise's father has been arrested for belief that he could be a Nazi sympathizer, and he is deemed that he should be interned for the duration of the war. He's allowed, though, to be reunited with his family at a camp in Crystal City, Texas. And so that's where Elise and her family are reunited, and it's also where she meets Mariko. And even though they seem to be worlds apart in the situation that they're in, they're just American teenagers that like the same things, like Cary Grant movies and Twinkies and cute boys. And so their friendship really helps to galvanize their identity, because they're both feeling like their identity is being stripped from them in the circumstance that they're in. And it's because of their friendship that they're going to be able to hold on to that identity when they're separated.
Many of us are familiar with the Japanese internment camps, but German and Italian Americans were also placed in these camps. And I read that the last year of the war is inspired by a little-known repatriation program during World War II. What happened to all these American citizens?
Well, a lot of them were not citizens. They were legal residents, but some, probably most, did not have U.S. citizenship. Their children did, of course, but Crystal City internment camp was a place where your whole family could go. So if you were arrested, if you were like Elise's dad, you were arrested, interned, you were separated from your family, your assets were frozen. It was very difficult for some of these families to get along without dad at home. And so you could ask to be sent to Crystal City, Texas. And in doing so, you knew that you were likely going to be repatriated. It wasn't a foregone conclusion, but that you knew that it was a place where they were drawing from to get American POWs and civilians home from behind enemy lines. They were involved in a prisoner exchange program with Berlin, and you knew that if you went to Crystal City, that was a possibility. And my character's father decides to take that risk because he needs to be home with his wife. His wife is not a very strong person. She's rather fragile. And so upwards of 2,000 German-Americans were transferred out of Crystal City, Texas, and repatriated to Germany the last year of the war in these prisoner exchanges. And I think all in all, at the end of the war, about 4,200 German and Italian Americans were sent to their home countries in exchange for about 2,300 American civilians and POWs.
The internment camp and repatriation program in your story involved, like we just mentioned, tearing a family away from their home in the United States and shipping them overseas to another country. And that is really reminiscent of the immigration debate going on today. Did you see these similarities with current events, or were you also inspired by them?
You know, it wasn't until someone else kind of pointed out to me the parallels that I really saw them. I think I was just so entranced with the past. I was spending all my attention focused on the past that it was another conversation I had with someone else, where they mentioned they were seeing kind of like that same conversation happening, where we are looking at how we're going to treat people who are different than us. And, you know, what is an immigrant? What is an American? What does it mean to have loyalty? And where is home? Like, what do you call home? Is home only ever going to be the place where you were born, or is home something else? And so all of those conversations that I was having with the past, with this book, I began to see, well, they're playing out again for us now in the 21st century. I think it's a good conversation to have when we're looking at who are we as Americans and who else fits the category of an American. I think unless you're a Native American, you know, we're all children of immigrants at some point. And so I think we don't want to forget that we're part of that bigger story.
You've written many books in the historical fiction genre, covering events such as the Spanish flu epidemic, the Golden Age of Hollywood, the Civil War. Are you a history buff? Is this where you get your inspiration for your fiction writing?
I guess I am a bit of a history buff. I do enjoy looking at the past. I think we learn a lot by seeing where we've come from. And I think the past has lessons to teach us, but, you know, only if we look at them. And I think historical fiction is uniquely able to transport you into the past. You know, there is no time machine. It's really the only way to go back in time is through the pages of fiction. I think nonfiction is great because that's where we learn the true facts and the details of the past. But really only fiction is transportive. It takes you into the life of a character, and you begin to experience that past through the decisions that the character makes and the things that happen to them. So I think for that reason, that's why history resonates with me, is because history is always about people, to me, first, before it's about facts and figures. It's about the people that lived that history, and that is always interesting to me.
That's Susan Meisner. Her new book is The Last Year of the War, a compelling work of historical fiction set in the final days of World War II. Susan, thank you so much for telling us about your new book.
It was truly my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
This is What We're Reading on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. And now it's time to pour a cup of coffee and get cozy with another community member and talk favorite books. Today we're talking with Ruthie Wilson from Bemidji. She's the president of the Bemidji League of Women Voters and a fellow book lover. Ruthie, what's the book you'd like to talk about today?
Thank you, Tammy. I would like to talk about a book called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn.
All right, tell me about it.
I first read this book when I was in college, so at the beginning of the 2000s, and it was one of those books that I was totally changed after I read it. So I just have always thought about the teachings that are in the novel and the way that they talk about different ideas that are represented by our culture. And it really was a milestone of, like, before I read the book and after I read the book, it made me into a different person in the way I think and process information about different cultures and things like that.
So I'm looking at a brief description of it online, and it says, "The narrator of this extraordinary tale is a man in search of the truth. He answers an ad in a local newspaper from a teacher looking for serious pupils, only to find himself alone in an abandoned office with a full-grown gorilla who is nibbling delicately on a slender branch. 'You are the teacher?' he asks incredulously. 'I am the teacher,' the gorilla replies." Is this how the story starts?
Interestingly enough, yes, it is.
What were you thinking when you read that part?
It took me a while to get past that part. I put the book down a couple times before finishing it because of that, and I thought it was going to be more science fiction. Turns out it's a good conversation between this gorilla and the man who ends up being his student. It's a little bit hard to get over the narration of that part, but it's not impossible, because what's being said in the book is ultimately more important than the people who are saying it.
Can you give us a little bit of the narrative? What happens after the man becomes the pupil?
Sure. The man, who is largely unnamed, keeps going back to visit Ishmael at the abandoned warehouse. And each time that he goes, Ishmael brings up a new topic of culture or the Cultural Revolution, and explains why our culture views agriculture as a savior, and why we think we're so flawed as humans, trying to make the world into a paradise but not really being able to, because we have these flaws that we're born with, we can't really get over. So we're kind of setting ourselves up for failure. But if we take a step back and separate ourselves, we realize we're all humans on this planet and we depend on the planet. So we need to be more in tune with it.
And how did you discover this book?
It was given to me by a great friend of mine who I went to school with in college.
And why do you think they thought you would like it?
At the time, I was searching for a different major and just doing some life rearranging, for lack of a better term, and decided to become an English major. And he was like, "You have to read this book. It's so influential. It's one of the ones that changed me, you know, to my core." And he just wanted to see what I would think about it so we could talk about it. And I ended up, after setting it down a few times, loving it. And I have bought probably 8 or 9 copies to give away to other people, because I just think it's that important.
That's great. That's a great idea to do with books that you really love.
Yeah, I love it too.
Did you get a warm reception from all the people you gave the books to?
Mostly. I mean, that's definitely a odd gift, yeah. I guess, nowadays. So, you know, mixed reactions. But people who've actually taken the time have mostly the same opinion that I do of the book.
Do you have a favorite line or part in the book that you could share with us?
Sure. Yeah. I love the quote that he uses and comes back to repeatedly, which is, "There is no one right way to live." And he uses it in many ways to talk about how our culture has created basically two groups, one called the leavers and one called the takers. The takers are our society, people who take and take from the planet and leave nothing in return. The leavers are more of the indigenous tribes or the hunters and gatherers before the Cultural Revolution of agriculture, and they left more behind. Mm-hmm. So the point that he makes with that quote is that just because one religion works for you doesn't mean it's going to work for everyone. It's not our place as humans to decide that for everyone. And that's really what the takers have done, is decide your culture is less than, so we're going to change it and we're going to leave you nothing. We're going to take you and make you ours. And we don't really leave a lot of room for people who don't agree with that. And I think it's really important. We need to agree and understand people will have different situations.
Right. What's an example of that quote coming up or having an impact on you kind of in a day-to-day way? Like, what's an example of that quote coming up and you thinking, oh, that reminds me of that line from that book?
In my job, I talk a lot to people from all over the United States and the world, and I always, when I'm frustrated, come back to that one line of, you know, is it my understanding or lack of understanding that makes me frustrated, or is it because, you know, there's really a reason? And I have to examine that a lot. So I think it's useful to me in many ways.
Is this a book that you will reread periodically?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I reread it about every 2 years.
What prompts you to pick this book up again?
That's a good question. I haven't picked it up for a while, I think, because I have such a long reading list that
I know that feeling.
It's, yeah, kind of overwhelming, and I want to read new things. In the past, I guess I've come back to it often when I want to talk about it or give it to someone so that, mm-hmm. you know, I can say why mm-hmm. exactly.
I do reread books, too, and it's usually, I don't know if it's that I'm seeking comfort, and maybe I don't know that I'm seeking comfort,
yeah.
but just by the act of reading something you really love and you're familiar with. But also, this sounds like a kind of book that you would get more out of every time you read it. You're going to get something new out of it every
yeah.
time you read it. Is that the case for you?
Yeah, I think it's both the familiarity of it and the aspect of like, whoa, I didn't realize that was in there, you know, or I forgot about that part.
Right.
Yeah, that's really important. And then he has two other books, one they call a sidequel kind of to Ishmael because it's happening at the same time in history, and it's called My Ishmael. And then there's another one called The Story of Bee that takes My Ishmael and combines them. And it's more of like a Bible of the two, to use that term loosely.
So you said a side quill?
Yeah.
So it kind of branches out, and then the third one kind of snags them both together
yeah,
again in a way.
Exactly. That's the really side quill is because they're happening at the same time in history. You don't get that okay. when you're reading the first one.
Sure.
You do know about the second book, the narrator from the first book, mm-hmm. they meet.
Do you like those two as much as the first? Do they kind of wrap things up really nicely for you, or could you have gone without them?
The story of Bee is incredible for combining the two. And My Ishmael takes the ideas from Ishmael and just expands on them and brings in the ideas of why our culture values education in the way it does and different ways of just, you know, living, religion, you know, working for your food and things like that. So I would say they're all important in their own right because they all really address their issues well. But then the story of Bee, if you want to just kind of get both of them together, would be the one that you would want to read.
This sounds like a really fascinating book, and it's going to show up in my giant to-read list now, too. So, Ruthie, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about this book.
Thank you, Tammy. It was great to be here.
Thank you.
You're listening to What We're Reading on 91.7 KAXE, 90.5 KBXE. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Still to come, our conversation with writer Lori Haltz Anderson about her new memoir, Shout. It recounts her experience as a sexual assault victim, and we'll talk about what we can all do to foster positive conversations about sexuality and consent. Stay tuned for that. The Minnesota Book Awards ceremony was held a couple weeks ago. Some really excellent books were nominated this year, and a lot of new titles you'll want to add to your reading list. Here are some of the winners. The award for children's literature went to Corey Dorfeld for The Rabbit Listened. When something terrible happens, Taylor doesn't know where to turn. All the animals are sure to have the answer. One by one, the animals try to tell Taylor how to process this loss, and one by one, they fail. Then the rabbit arrives. All the rabbit does is listen, which is just what Taylor needs. The award for general nonfiction went to Maya Dusenberry for her book, Doing Harm, the truth about how bad medicine and lazy science leave women dismissed, misdiagnosed, and sick. In Doing Harm, Dusenberry provides a comprehensive, accessible look at how sexism in medicine harms women today, bringing together scientific and sociological research, interviews with doctors and researchers, and personal stories from women across the country. Brian Freeman is the winner of the award for genre fiction for his book, The Voice Inside. 4 years after serial killer Rudy Cutter was sent away for life, homicide inspector Frost Easton uncovers a terrible lie. His closest friend planted false evidence to put Cutter behind bars. When he's forced to reveal the truth, the killer is back on the streets. Staying ahead of a killer who's determined to strike again won't be easy, not when the killer's next move is unlike anything Frost expected. The award for memoir and creative nonfiction went to Wing Young Hui for his book Chineseness, The Meaning of Identity and the Nature of Belonging. Is Chinese identity personal, national, cultural, political? Does it migrate, become malleable, or transmuted? Using documentary and conceptual photographic strategies, Hui explores the meaning of Chineseness in his home state of Minnesota, throughout the United States, and in China. Susan Bartlett Foote is the recipient of the Award for Minnesota Nonfiction for her book, The Crusade for Forgotten Souls, Reforming Minnesota's Mental Institutions, 1946 to 1954. It recounts Minnesota's reform movement that broke the stigma surrounding mental illness, publicized the painful truth about the state's asylums, and resulted in the first legislative steps towards a modern mental health system. Foote tells the story of early advocates for compassionate care of the mentally ill who made the crusade a success. The award for novel and short story went to Sarah Stonich for Laurentian Divide. Returning to the northern Minnesota town of Hatchet Inlet, Laurentian Divide picks up the story where Stonich's novel Vacation Land left off, providing a poignant portrayal of life on the edge in border country. Our own Heidi Holton interviewed Sarah last fall on The Morning Show. Here's some of that conversation about Laurentian Divide.
I feel like this book is about the people here, the life we lead here. And I was really impressed with the realness of these folks instead of kind of sometimes in media, in books, it's like life is portrayed here as sort of quaint, hilarious people, but not very real.
Well, I think there's a stereotype for sure of the Minnesota character, and I feel like it's kind of my goal to break that somewhat. You know, there's this Minnesota ideal of who we are, and I mean, I have to say, not all my children are above average, and not all my my men are good looking. So I think they're more real. They're real to me.
Yeah. Well, and I think we get to meet them through some fun times, some difficult times in their life, which kind of is exactly like how we live our lives. And so this town is called Harbor Inlet that you've written about, and they have this regular sign of spring where this man comes back to town. I wonder if you'd tell us about him.
Rory Parr is based very, very loosely on a Dorothy Moulter sort of character who, only because she was more or less grandfathered into the BWCAW, which in my work is called the reserve, that big chunk of land. And so Rory is the male version of that, and he's been grandfathered in. So he gets to keep his land until he either dies or leaves the island. And he normally comes in the spring right after ice out, but he hasn't shown up yet. And that's where the story begins.
I wonder if you'd talk about place a little bit more, what the place means to the folks within Laurentian Divide, what northern Minnesota means to you.
You know, sometimes it almost feels like it's imprinted in our DNA sometimes when we're very connected to a place. It doesn't always mean that that is a fabulous relationship. Sometimes it can feel like a tie. I myself have kind of a love-hate relationship with northern Minnesota. I come and go. I'm back and forth, and sometimes we break up, and sometimes we get back together. And I think our place, where we are raised, if we have anything at all to do with the outdoors and with the people, it's hard to let go of any place, and you'll find that in a few of the characters as well. I mean, there's two returnees that are kind of unexpected, Pete and Meg. Because of so many small towns that we know of now, kids grow up, they go off to college, and not too many come back.
That was KAXE-KBXE News Director Heidi Holton talking with writer Sarah Stonich about her award-winning book, Laurentian Divide. Continuing on with our list of 2019 Minnesota Book Award winners, the award for poetry went to Chon Webster for his book Gentrification, or The Scene of the Crime. Webster investigates race in his debut collection, drawing inspiration from sign and graffiti, layering of collage, and the visual experience of text. He engages the question of absence, how to archive what is missing from the landscape, particularly as a number of communities watch in real time as neighborhoods once populated with familiar presences dissolve in the vernacular of redevelopment and its linked colonial logic. And finally, the award for young adult literature went to Shannon Gibney for Dream Country. In 1926, Togar flees deep into the Liberian bush, desperate to escape a militia. In 1980, Uje and Evelyn dare to believe their love can survive Liberia's fast-approaching revolution. In 2008, Coley cracks under the strain of life as a teenage Liberian refugee in Minneapolis. Dream Country is the story of five generations of young people from one African-American family chasing an elusive dream across centuries and continents. Congratulations to all of these authors representing Minnesota. You can find the link to the list of winners on our KAXE, KBXE What We're Reading page on Facebook or at kaxe.org. Lori Haltz Anderson is the best-selling author of many books, among them the 1999 award-winning novel Speak, a story about sexual assault that opened the door for a national dialogue about rape culture and consent. And now 20 years later, she's published a free verse memoir revealing her own story as a sexual assault survivor. The book is called Shout, and Lori Haltz Anderson joins us now. Lori, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Your new book, Shout, is your memoir, but written in free verse style. How did you decide to share your personal story in poems?
When I listened to the backlash that greeted the women in Hollywood back in the fall of 2017, who made accusations against Harvey Weinstein and thus elevated Tarana Burke's Me Too movement, I was incandescently angry. I was enraged because I've been listening to survivors for 20 years. And the lines of poetry just started to drop in my head. I've read and written poetry my entire life. And for me, poetry is the artistic form that can either create a punch or it can embrace the reader. And those are the two feelings that I knew I wanted to explore in this book, so it seemed to make sense.
Shout is your life's story as a sexual assault victim and survivor. It must have been difficult to share so much of your painful and private and personal story with the world.
I've actually been sharing it for a long time. When Speak came out in 1999, English teachers began putting it in curriculum. It's a standard in curriculum across the country now. And then I quickly began to receive invitations to visit schools all over the country and to talk about the book. And I realized early on that the kids were not there to talk to me about themes and metaphors. They really wanted to understand what had happened to me. What were my family dynamics that made it so difficult for me to speak up about what had happened to me? Because when I was raped at age 13, I didn't tell anybody for 23 years. So I've been sharing a lot of these stories face-to-face with teenagers for two decades now. I became very comfortable talking about it, you know, in that intimacy of an audience. So I've been prepared for a long time to share it with the world. What we have to remember is that the days of shame are over. There is no shame in being the victim of a crime. The shame lies with the perpetrator, not the victim.
Let's talk about it from a crime point of view a little more. The nation's sexual assault statistics are alarming. In your recent article in Time magazine, you quote a statistic from the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. Every 98 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted. Has society failed us in this respect?
We have failed each other completely. Those statistics generally on the RAIN website come from the Department of Justice, so they're pretty solid statistics, but I think they're undercounted, frankly. We have failed each other because we are uncomfortable talking about healthy sexuality in our culture, which is kind of bizarre when you think about it, because we put it everywhere. It's on all of the screens. We use sexual imagery to sell everything from dishwashing soap to blue jeans. Most of our boys are beginning to see pornography on phones around age 11 or 12, but we've never had a generation of adults who are comfortable talking to kids or to each other about things like consent, about healthy sexuality, about sex positivity. And so in the absence of informed, responsible conversations, we have generation after generation of children growing up without knowing what the rules are, without knowing what the laws are. And then for those who are victims, and let's remember that victims aren't just girls and women, they're boys and men, and they're people who identify outside that binary. Whomever is hurt by any kind of sexual violence, molestation, or abuse, in the absence of adults who are willing to talk about these things, they often don't seek the help that they really, really need, because the message that they've gotten is that we don't talk about this.
Can you elaborate a little more maybe on what real things can be done to make this better?
Oh, absolutely. How much time do you have? This is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and there are lots of resources online that people can and should take advantage of. If you just Google that, you'll be taken to Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and there's wonderful information about this year's theme, which is I Ask. In this country and many places around the world, we're moving to a very healthy, consent-based model of healthy sexuality. That means before you touch another person, you ask. And I don't know about the listeners, but in our house, you know, we've got six grandsons, and we begin teaching consent when they're two. No, you don't touch him unless, you know, do you want to play? You know, can I give you a hug? Those are just basic conversations that give children the agency of their bodies and teach them to consent, that consent goes both ways. And sometimes people can say no, and when somebody doesn't want to be hugged or doesn't want to be touched, we respect that. So beginning those conversations when kids are young is the way that leads us to the conversations about healthy, consent-based sexuality when they're older. And I think we have to kind of change our mindset a little bit. It's not that parents have to have the one conversation with their kids. We wouldn't have one conversation with our children about how to drive a car safely because we understand the inherent risks in driving. There's also inherent risks in our children not understanding that sex can and should be a healthy part of intimate relationships, but there are also rules to make sure that all of our children are protected. So we have to find, you know, and some parents squirm a bit with that thought of talking to their kids about these things, which makes sense. Their parents didn't talk to them. But in pushing beyond our discomfort and having the conversations with our kids, we're giving them the model of what it looks like to talk about things that might feel a little awkward at first. They desperately need that model. At the same time, we are all called for kind of operating deeply in love so that when somebody comes to us and shares what they've been through, we're not judging, we're not criticizing, we're just listening intently, making sure that person feels safe, and then ask, how can I help you?
You're listening to What We're Reading. We'll continue our conversation with Lori Holtz Anderson in just a moment.
But no one knows me.
That song is Quiet by the singer Milk. We now continue our conversation with Lori Holtz Anderson. I was really moved by all of the people in your book, strangers who confided in you of their own painful experiences, young women, young men, and particularly the man you mentioned in Shout who said to you, "I am Melinda," referring to the main character, the rape survivor Melinda from your 1999 novel, Speak. What does hearing from people like this mean to you?
I've never given a presentation in 20 years without having had at least one, and sometimes dozens, of people come up to me afterwards wanting to share their story. At first, it came as a surprise. But now I understand what an opportunity that is and what a gift that is to me. Because what it means is that I've said something or I've created a safe, brave space where people have confidence that they can talk to me. And I'm honored by that. I'm honored. What it shows me over and over and over again is how much we've failed our people. How much we failed our sisters and our brothers, because we've bought into this, you know, centuries-old model that somehow the victims of sexual violence are the ones who have, I don't even understand it, magical control over the bodies of the person who hurt them. And when you examine trauma, for example, so somewhere north of 90% of victims of sexual violence develop symptoms of PTSD within 2 weeks after their attack. 20 years after the attack, sometimes you can have up to 50% of those victims still experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. We know that PTSD is a generational issue. that children raised in households with adults who have PTSD often develop the symptoms themselves. So what we're talking about, in a culture that doesn't allow victims and survivors credibility and doesn't help them find the resources to cope with what happened to them, because this is absolutely something that is survivable. You can regain your strength, you can regain your health, you can regain your trust and your ability to enjoy healthy sexuality. But a lot of people need assistance for that. So when people come to me, the first thing I do is to, you know, talk to them and make sure that their life is in a safe place. Sometimes people choose silence because the person who hurt them lives in their house. And that is has layers of complications, as you can well imagine. And then I help them try to find resources in their own area, because I'm not licensed for anything, right? We want them to turn to the experts who can really help them. I have this dream that soon everybody who's been hurt will feel confident enough in the reception that they're going to have to start speaking up and get the help that they really, really deserve, because that's going to help their families. That's going to help them choose a life that's based on their strength instead of a life that's based on protecting their scars.
Speaking of therapy, you yourself sought therapy, but not until many years after the rape. You kind of went into it a little bit about what therapy can actually do for them. So maybe there's somebody listening who's like, I've always been afraid of seeking therapy. Can you talk about what it can do for them, even if they've waited for several years to share this horrific event with other people?
It's very, very common for victims of sexual violence to not seek therapy for decades. You know, especially when we're teenagers, we often think that, oh, well, you know, I can handle this. A lot of victims are assaulted in college, and they try to put it behind them and move forward. And for some people, that works. My guess is, and my experience talking to people, is that for most people, it doesn't work completely. What happened to me is that I tried to put it behind me, didn't tell anybody. I was so afraid that if I told anybody in my family, my father would shoot the boy who attacked me. And then that would be my fault and my dad would be in jail. And that's why I didn't say anything. And when you get into the habit of not saying anything, that habit can be hard to break. What happened is 23 years after my attack, I realized that my depression was really hurting my children. My mother didn't talk about things, and so we had this kind of culture of silence growing up. But I was turning into that mom who wasn't very communicative. I would spend hours just kind of sitting and staring out the window. And we're acculturated as women often to not put our own needs first. But when we can see the needs of the people we love not being met because we're struggling, that's my case. That's what finally took me to a therapist's office. And it took me some time before I could trust this person enough to tell her what happened. And when I finally took that deep breath and revealed it, I started to cry an entire river, decades of pain. And unleashing that and getting support, you know, it strengthened me in ways that I didn't know was possible. So my message for anybody who has this or anything else painful in their past that's still dogging them, if you have feelings of low self-worth, if you find that you're turning to drugs or alcohol or other kinds of anesthetics to help numb the pain, to help numb some of those old feelings that are haunting you, I really encourage you to reach out and get the help that you deserve. It completely changed my life.
What do you hope to accomplish by sharing your story in Shout?
We are ready to make a change. I have never had a book received the way this book has been received. I have audiences of hundreds of people coming out. And it's interesting because they're coming out in groups of adults. Although I write for children, I think this is the crossover issue, sexual abuse, molestation, and violence. So many adults were hurt when they were kids, teens, or in their 20s, and they're still processing. They're still trying to come to grips and find that courage to speak up so that they can, you know, be honored for what they went through and to live a healthier, safer, better life. And they're eager to make changes within their community, not only on a personal level, not only on a family level, but we're looking for the language, right? This is all about communication. We're looking for the language to raise up a generation of kids in a healthier way. We're looking for the language to talk to our sons, to talk to our boys about the fact that you have to have a conversation with somebody before you have sex with them. Instead of just saying, put a condom on it, you have to say, no, you need to actually find out from your potential partner if they want to have sex, and that means using your words, which is what we start telling them when they're three. Your partner needs to be an enthusiastic participant in any kind of sexual activity. If you don't have the enthusiasm, you don't have consent. It feels like we're ready to change how we have enjoyable sexual interactions now. And also it's time for us to look back. I'm not sure if you know about this, but there are hundreds of thousands of untested rape kits sitting on the shelves in police stations across the country. There are a number of organizations, including RAIN and the Joyful Heart Foundation, that are raising funds and raising awareness so that law enforcement will go and test all those rape kits. The people who commit rape generally don't do it just once. So we have evidence waiting on police shelves that could be protecting future victims. So there's a lot of different areas where our willingness to speak up and to listen is actually changing the face of the culture. And it's really exciting to be a part of that.
Lori Holtz Anderson's new book is called Shout, available through Viking. It's her free verse, personal history as a survivor of sexual assault. It is deeply personal and important work. I hope you will check out this book. Lori, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I hope it helps others to heal and inspire change.
I appreciate that. Let's keep shouting together.
I can't keep quiet.
This has been What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Thanks for tuning in today. What We're Reading is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Every song.